Two Sister Drinker. Nothing's going to change in that. Thank you, Billy.
Yeah.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. Joe Sullivan. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
And it's nice to be back in Madison. I have with me tonight Andrew. Andrew right there. Andrew's been here before because he came last, it was on Super Bowl Sunday night, I think it was. Yeah. Right. And so we had a wild wild time getting up here, and on the way back, we were able to tune in a station from Cincinnati and keep it with us until 2:88 down in Richmond, and that was so we got to hear the good parts of the ballgame, and we had a good trip. And also Jim, there he is back there. Jim is visiting Richmond. He's been living over in Hawaii for a while. He left us last year. Was it last year, Jim? Yeah, wow. And he's in town for a few days, and he said, "Yahoo, let's go to Madison." So here we are. Yeah. And I've had the pleasure of sponsoring both of these guys, Jim, until he left town and did what he was supposed to do, and was find a sponsor in Hawaii. And Andrew is going away to law school next month, and I think I'll keep him on a short leash from Richmond. It's nice to be here. It really is. And I see some people who may be relatively new to AA. Is that correct? Or have you all been here a while? No. Okay. All right. I have to start by telling you that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. And Alcoholics Anonymous is not a big building in New York. It's not a big building anywhere. It is us, right here, right now. This is Alcoholics Anonymous as we know it today, in this room. Because you people have been so good to me in helping to me to recover from my alcoholism. You've helped me fill a void that I think exists in the breast of every human being except those who are, you know, just mentally incapacitated to have some positive impact in the life of somebody else. And you know, I get ample opportunities, like tonight is one of those, to fill up, you know, that void, to keep it full, to keep it rolling, keep it going. And if you hang around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, you'll find out that as you work with others and as you're of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, it'll do the same for you. I was sitting down, and Andrew's familiar with this spot, and so is in Jim. There's a McDonald's near my house, and we call it the Gucci McDonald's because it's so very finely styled and finished. And it's got a nice little patio out front, which we make great use of during the summertime. And then we have a healing booth inside when the weather is bad. So I'm meeting generally two or three nights a week with somebody, either in the healing booth or on the healing patio. And I was out there with one of my guys the other night, and he was giving me feedback about how his outlook and attitude on life had changed. And I'm saying, don't stop. Don't stop. I think I was levitating when I walked away. Not because I had much to do with what happened in his life, but because Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, had lessons that I could pass on how to live. And I'm blown away by what this guy is telling me, because it's exactly, you know, where Alcoholics Anonymous takes us. We find out that from in the discipline of living by the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, we gain immense freedoms. And that sounds like a paradox, doesn't it? I had a wise man say that to me one time, and it took me years and years and years to begin to find out what it meant. I found out when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It says in the foreword to the 12 and 12, and nobody ever reads the foreword to anything. I don't, for the most part. In the foreword to the 12 and 12, it says, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are principles that are spiritual in nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the compulsion to drink and allow the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And I want you to know right now, there's another promise you can take with you from Alcoholics Anonymous. That's exactly what's happening to me. And I'm right here on the learning curve, folks. So I haven't seen the view from the top of the mountain yet, and I hope I never do, because once I get to the top of the mountain, I'm in trouble. Because then I'm going to start patting myself on the back for what a wonderful job I've done with my sobriety, and my ego will be out there in front of the footlights going, "Bravo, Encore," you know, and I'll be finished. I grew up with all the tendencies of an alcoholic. I really did. From my earliest memories, I experienced very fierce rage at the world around me. I learned over time to play your silly games so I wouldn't get in too much trouble. I learned over time to contain myself a little bit anyway, so I could avoid the serious consequences that came with the kind of behaviors I would rather indulge in. And that's before I started drinking. I threw a punch at a nun my second day in first grade. The kid in front of me had turned around to ask me something and knocked my bottle of milk into my lap, and she came during my lap, and she came tearing down the aisle, and she slapped me, and she hit me first, so I took one at her. Now, I didn't get through the fabric. I may have bruised my knuckles on the rosary beads, but you know, she had set the pace for me in my subsequent educational experiences. The nun, in fact, who graduated me from that high school, from that grade school, said to Mr. Sullivan, "I give you these marks, not because you deserve them, but because I live in fear of having you in my class again next year." I said I'd take them any way I could, you know. I didn't even show up for graduation anyway. I was over in the boiler room in the school smoking a cigarette, and my mother and sisters were, as I emerged from the boiler room and out on the school steps, were walking down. My two sisters were supporting my mother, and she was in tears because I didn't graduate. She didn't know what the hell happened either. And so you can sense there a little resistance to authority. And as a result of that kind of resistance, I went to three different high schools, one of them twice. They were kind enough to take me back, and I'm glad they did, because that's the only way I got through high school. It just went on like that. I wanted to fit in and be like everybody else, but I couldn't. You see, I was shy. I was sensitive. My sponsor said, "No, not sensitive, Joe, touchy." Shy, sensitive. And all of those things. And I covered all of that up with arrogance. I was full of envy. I was full of jealousy. But I learned how to shake myself to some kind of a mold that would be acceptable to the world around me, at least while they were looking. Okay? I had my first experience with alcohol. I come from Springfield, Massachusetts, by the way. And there are lots of Irishmen up there. There are pages full of Sullivans in the phone book. Yeah. We had to give each other nicknames, you know, B-Sull, C-Sull, Fat-Sull, Skinny Skull, you know, just lay them all out there. Otherwise, we'd all get confused about which house we're supposed to go to at the end of the day. And there was a lot of drinking going on. It was known, I learned later, as the Irish virus. You know, there were some Irishmen, you know, drank a little. Many Irishmen drank a lot. And some drank too much. But the word alcoholic or drunk was not much heard in family circles. It was, "That poor man is sick," you know. Well, they had that part right. I remember, and Irish mothers, by the way, never had alcoholics or crazies for children. They always had an excuse. And they always put crazy brother in the closet when company came. You know, gave him 25 cents to go to the movies. Get out of the house. We don't want to lose our reputation as a fine family. I sort of said, you know, this drinking thing must be pretty nice. A lot of people did it. A lot of people came in on a cold day and said, I think I'll have just a little nip to take the chill off. I learned how to work that one into my scheme. And had never tasted alcohol until I was on a sabbatical from this school that asked me to reconsider my commitment to their kind of education. It happened to be in the wintertime. And I was setting up pins in a bowling alley. And I had to walk about 7 blocks to my house when it shut down at 10:30 at night. And I want to tell you, in New England in the wintertime, it can get very, very, very cold. So here I go, trudging to my house. It's about 0 degrees temperature. There's snow on the ground, and there's a 30-knot kicker coming down from Canada. So when I hit the front door of my house, my corduroys are frozen. And I walked into the kitchen, and there was a bottle of Pastini port wine on the table. And I can tell you that's what it was, because the label is emblazoned on my cerebellum. Okay? And we lived in a bungalow. My folks were upstairs, and they were in bed. So I went up and used that ploy. May I have a little bit of that wine just to take the chill off? And my mother, God bless her, she died at 94 years old, totally innocent, said, help yourself, son. So I went down. It was cheap wine. I screwed the top, and I put some in a glass, and I drank it, and I loved the warmth I got from it, and I filled up the glass again and drank it, and all of a sudden, I was on the top of the world looking down on creation. My God. I wasn't, you know, way down here looking way up there trying to figure out what the hell was going on and what I should be doing, you know? And that lasted until my sister came home. She worked the swing shift. but I was just where I wanted to be. Free from all the chains of inferiority and shyness and things like that. I was so shy that people thought I was either so smart that I was waiting to, you know, I saved up to say what I was going to say, and or aloof, one or the other. But I wasn't shy that night. And when my sister saw me marching around the kitchen, you know, having this wonderful time, she went up and notified my parents. Ratted me out. That's what she did. And about the time my mother got down there to see what was happening, I was, you know, it was coming up just the way it went down, you know, freshly minted. And so she started pouring coffee into me. And she said, son, I'll bet you'll never do that again. You know, I mean, all she got for her efforts was a wide awake drunk, you know. I'm over caffeine. I'm a kid. I don't have a big body. Well, I want you to know, I did not go out the next night looking for more of this Pastini port wine. Fortunately, my physical makeup is such that I can only drink for so long anyway. You know, and then I get so sick I couldn't drink. And that's something I kept all of my life. I was not one of these guys that you know, could go on a 5-day binge. I had to stop around day 3, perhaps, just to cool off. You know, to get over the leaps. You know the leaps, right? That's what they gave Bill Wilson belladonna for. But it was during the spring thaw of that same year, or the next year following that. The spring came around, that 4 of us were going up the avenue to shoot a game of pool. And God, in His infinite mercy, exposed to me the neck of a whiskey bottle sticking out of a melting snowbank under a street light. Now, I'd never tasted whiskey in my life, folks, but I took to it like a bird dog. I went over, I grabbed it, I knew how to unscrew the top, I'd already done that with the wine. And I took a big slug of that stuff, and I passed it around to my friends, and they spat, and they coughed, and they went, ooh, you know? And that's the last time I ever drank with Protestants, so. Unless, of course, they were buying, then I would give them a dispensation. Okay. I was able to maintain the pace of my drinking for 36 years. That's a pretty good run. I operated on the theory that if in doing what I was doing when I was drinking or drunk, I didn't get caught, then it wasn't trouble. Guess what? I never got caught. I never had a DUI. Not ever. And I had done blackout driving. In retrospect, I did a lot of blackout driving because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and you guys were talking about blackouts, I didn't know what the heck you're talking about, right? Never happened to me. Then I had to ask myself the question, what were you doing up on the Canadian border as the sun was coming up over the horizon when you were supposed to be in Hartford, Connecticut covering a football game? Oh, maybe that was a blackout. When I got through thinking about all such incidents, I knew I had more blackouts than London during the Blitz. You know, I had them. I had them on a consistent basis. I just didn't recognize them for what they were. You gave me a name, right, for what was going on in my life, as you did when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. You gave me a name what was going on in Joe Sullivan's life inside. When I finally graduated high school, I did what most of the other guys in my neighborhood were doing. They were joining the Marine Corps, and they would come home in these beautiful, you know, uniforms and with a girl on either arm, and I said, that's for me. And so I went up to the Marine Corps when I was 18 years old, and I stayed there for 2 years because that's all I was required to do. And besides that, I was getting restless and irritable and discontented. And so I got out and did a number of things in a short period of time. I was the editor and half owner of a weekly newspaper in a town of 13,000 people. I was 23 years old. They thought I was much older. I knew how to act older. I knew how to talk older. Because when I was a kid, I was about, you know, that tall until I was 14. And I used to hang around with the big guys. I was handy for them. They could boost me through a window, you know. So I see that window up there on the second floor of that store there, Joe. We could get up, drain pipe, and go in that window and come down and open up the front door, you know. I was a perfect foil for their crimes. And I was their gopher. I'd do almost anything they asked me to do. Because that gave me major standing with people my own age. I remember one day they said to me, Joe, you know that big umbrella in your hall? At home? Yeah. Go get it. Meet us around the corner by the streetlight. We are going to gather a crowd, and you are going to parachute off that pole with that umbrella. We're going to collect money, and then we'll all go eat ice cream or steal candy or something. And I said, what a good idea. So I got this thing and walked it out of the house like this. Met them around the corner. Sure enough, they had a crowd gathered there, and they were collecting pennies and nickels and whatever. And they said, okay, up the pole. And I went up the pole. They had climbing spikes on them. Now, do they still? I'm afraid to look. I really have not consciously registered whether they do or don't. And I said, okay. So I climb up there, and they said, open the umbrella. Umbrella open. Jumping. I'm going to tell you what happens. There's a sequence of three events when you step off a telephone pole like that with an umbrella. One, the umbrella inverts immediately. Your speed increases dramatically. It hurts like hell when you hit the sidewalk. Okay? P.S. I never got any of the money. But that became an important part of my coming into sobriety before it was all over. Now I'll tie that in for you as we go along. Yeah, so here I am. I'm the president of the Chamber of Commerce and the secretary of the Industrial Development Commission and the managing editor of a weekly newspaper in a town of 13,000 people. I have this powder blue Ford Victoria convertible or whatever brand style it was, on which, during the parades, runner-up from Miss Massachusetts, who happened to be my girlfriend, would ride. I was somebody. I was so good at hiding what I was really doing that I had one guy ask me one night if I knew anything about Big Brother, the Big Brother movement. My question to him was, no, but where can I get one? Because I knew where I was. He didn't. I could picture myself in a role trying to tell other people how to lead, you know, straight and useful lives. Fortunately, I didn't bite, and he left the car shaking his head, wondering why I asked the question. And then I got into radio, and then I did a little bit of television, but my reputation caught up with me really quickly there. I ended my radio career over in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia. It was an awfully good place to hide. Then I took a look around and I said, Sullivan, you were not a good civilian. You did well in the Marine Corps while you were in. You obviously, you know, exist well under controlled situations and environments. And I went back in. I was probably the oldest PFC they had at that time. In fact, when they gave me my issue, they said, take this cane, old man, and be careful going down the steps, you know. But there was something about the Marine Corps that I found very attractive. And that was, it was a pretty level playing field. I used to be envious when I was a kid of the guys who had all of those nice clothes and the bucks, you know, the white bucks and, you know, the snappy sports clothes and, you know, the fancy tennis rackets, of which I had none. And in the Marine Corps, everybody wore the same uniform. Everybody was there for one reason, and that was to save their buddy's life. And I thought that was rather noble, you know. And so we had a common purpose, and there was something special about the Marine Corps anyway. It's called esprit de corps. There was a spiritual factor there that nobody's been able to nail down, but Marines know all about. So that was good for me. In fact, it's as close to AA as I've ever come in terms of singleness of purpose and fellowship. I mean, it was great in that respect, and I stayed in the Marine Corps for another 10 years. And while I was in there, I got married to a young lady. I was out of Cyprus. I was at the embassy out there. And she was working for the CIA as a secretary. She was from Indiana. And I asked her to marry me, and she said, sure. And I made her all sorts of promises about what a loving husband and eventually father I would be, you know, and what a family we would have, and what a life was ahead of us. And she thought that was a grand idea, and we got married, and we came back to the States and started raising that family. We're down at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And a lot was going on in the world. For one period of time, while she was down there with those two little carpet babies, I was deployed overseas for a total of 16 months with only 10 days at home. And when I got back from Vietnam, I told her, I said, you know, I'm not living up to the promise that I made you. I don't owe the Marine Corps any time. You know, I hang around for another 8 years and take retirement, but I'm going to, you know, live my vow to you. I'm going to get out of the Marine Corps. Oh, she said, what a great idea. And I did. And I took a job as a traveling salesman. Can you not admire the alpha logic here? Them and I could go out on Monday, and I could come back on Friday. All that time was mine. You know, I had to do some work in there, but nobody was, you know, leaning on me to get it done. So I could raise Joe's kind of hell basically 4 days a week, because I tried to taper off by Thursday. So I'd come home, you know, and be looking halfway decent. And then we would have the candlelit dinners, and, you know, we would have all of these things going on. And she, oh, God, she loved that. But I knew. You see, I could control my weekends, because I knew on Monday I could go back on the road and I could start all over again. She told me one time, she says, you know, I really don't mind your drinking. Well, why should she? You know, I got romantic. I said yes to everything, you know. I've got a 43-year-old daughter. About every other year, she'll ask me, "Dad, am I ever going to get that damn horse?" <You know? laughs> And I build my little castles, you know, and tell her how the future was going to be and so on and so forth. And the fact of the matter was, I was making great strides as a clothing salesman out on the road. I started out selling dresses, dresses and things like that, calling on trade up here in Virginia. I came out of Charlotte, and eventually, ladies, I got into selling lingerie. Okay, I'm an expert, by the way, on slits. See me after the meeting if you're having a problem. And I kept on getting better and better jobs, earning more and more money. And before it was all over, I was the key account salesman for a very distinguished national firm, and I was covering just the major stores up in Washington and Baltimore, the Garfinkels, the Woodies, you know, and all of those. And I was sort of a hero in the company and well-known in my trade as a successful salesman. What they didn't know was what I did, you know, in those hours between, you know, 9 in the morning, which was my first appointment, or prior to 9 in the morning, after I got off from work. And I was getting juiced up pretty regularly by that time. Not always drunk, but certainly, you know, mellowed out to the point where I could relax and take advantage of situations that were in front of me. And when all was said and done, and I hate to have to tell you this, but when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous on December the 20th, 1983, for all of the status I had established in my industry, for all of the money I had made, you know, getting the job done, and there were some big bucks in there, for the proper home with the two kids and a couple of cars and all of that in the right kind of neighborhood, I was dead broke. I mean, lack of power was certainly a dilemma in my house. There's an economic axiom that any time you spend more than you earn on a consistent basis, bad things happen. They cut off the lights, they cut off the telephone, they cut off the water. I used to look at the water guy out there sinking his thing down, you know, turning the valve. And as soon as he made the corner, I was out there. I had made a homemade tool. I was turning it back on. When I went to the food line for my MVP card, they asked me to come back with a co-signer. No kidding. I remember calling the power company one day. I said, "I just got back into town. I haven't been able to send you a check, but I'll put one in the mail. I'll take it to the post office right now." And they said, "We're sorry, Mr. Sullivan. We can't take your checks anymore." They said, "But we will take a credit card." I said, "Too late. They already did, you know." And my wife, had had enough. She went to a lawyer. He said, don't forget to bring the tax returns. He said, you have no place to go and no money to get there with. We just celebrated 45 years, by the way. And believe it or not, we almost get along. We're having some talk not long ago. You know, we're of that age where we have to make sure our affairs are in order. And my wife happens to be Jewish. And she said, "Not to worry. It's going to be a murder-suicide." I was afraid to ask her what my part was going to be in that scenario, you know. I mentioned it to one of my AA friends, and he said, "Joe, did you ever think that she might just be kidding about the suicide part?" As I neared the end of my drinking campaign, she would leave the Dear Abbeys. You know, I don't know why I trust that woman. She was sneaking out and going to, guess what, Al-Anon meetings. Yeah. I mean, they taught her too many things in a short period of time. because now I couldn't come in the house half drunk and on the offensive and get away with it because she paid no attention to me. I had lost all my power in the relationship. And I could slam cabinet doors and she wouldn't budge. I could scream at her and she wouldn't answer. Why is the kitchen floor like nothing? And good for her. But she would start slipping these things on my dresser, the Dear Abby's. And I'm sitting in a buyer's office one day, and there's a runner's magazine on the coffee table in the buyer's office, and I picked that up and started reading, and I said, ha ha. It said, the best way to replace the minerals and the electrolytes lost in jogging is beer at the rate of a six-pack a mile. I slapped that on her dresser. In about 5 days, I was up to 4 miles. You know, I had a license to drink. But she said, you know, once again, she was very tolerant. She said, you know, the only problem with you is when you drink, you don't know when to stop. Well, I always had a ready answer. I'm Irish. I'm glib, you know. And I said, well, fact is I do. Unfortunately, I get drunk before I hit it, you know. But all of this Al-Anon stuff coming from her was beginning to get my attention. And I was going to bed one night, and I had my usual knockout drink sitting on the nightstand. And I put my head on the pillow, and I relived that day I parachuted off the telephone pole with the umbrella. That same empty feeling ran through me. That same, oh my God, I am no longer in control of my fate, hit me to the quick. And I said to her, I need help. And she said to me, you sure do. We had a couple we used to socialize with, and I liked the husband very much. He was exactly who I would like to be when I grew up. He was a very accomplished guy. He was well-spoken. He was very intelligent. He was a snappy dresser. He should have been on the cover of Business Week magazine, you know. He had been very successful in his career, and I liked him. I could never get close to him. But she knew something about him I didn't. And one of the reasons I couldn't get close to him was because every time we got together, I got drunk. And he wouldn't tolerate it, you know. He wasn't going to give me a hug at those prices. And she called him. He had been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years, and I'm sure I was not his first 12-step call. I'm sure he did a refresher in Chapter 7 of the Big Book. Because at 9 o'clock the next morning when I was trying to find, you know, the bathroom. Oh, my God. Oh, God. You know, you look in the mirror and the mirror starts moving. Please do not adjust this mirror. We are experiencing technical difficulty. Oh, okay. I thought it was me. The phone rang and it nearly blew me through the tile. And he said, Joe, this is John. Hi, John. Do you really want to stop drinking? Now, I learned as a salesman that sometimes there was more being said in the silence than there was in the words. And there was something ominous being said in the silence right here. And it said, if you don't say yes, he's hanging up. And I said, yes, I do. And I didn't know if I was a drunk. You know, an alcoholic anyway. I mean, you know, my vision of the alcoholic had been set for me early. I asked the priest one time, what's an alcoholic? He said, that's somebody who drinks so much the night before that he can't get up in the morning and go to work. Guess who got up in the morning and went to work? I was in New York a lot, 5 or 6 weeks a year working major clothing markets. And I loved Manhattan, honest to God. The bars only had to close down for 2 hours. And all not at the same time. So if you pace this right... I mean, you could just keep on going. And I would get back to my hotel room at 7, 7:30 in the morning. I would lean against the wall. I would be afraid to lie down. Lean against the wall, but eventually start to slide down. That would wake me up. I'd go in, do two bottles of Visine. I remember one time I didn't have time to shave, so I took talcum powder. Well, they looked at me funny when I got to the showroom. I don't know why. Oh, where the heck was I? Oh. Things like that. I just had bad. I also thought, and I have very good reason to believe this, because of a drunk ex-husband that used to come back into our neighborhood to harass his wife, and one of us with a driver's license would have to take him down to the Salvation Army. So I had you guys, Salvation Army equated. And I knew if I went to the Salvation Army, you'd find out that I had a musical background, and it would be put a nickel in the drum, play it. I'd be out there with a horn. Help another drunken bum, and that was not me. I wore nice suits and nice ties, and I drove a nice car. And I was a successful salesman, But anyway, I didn't know who you were. John said to me, he said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to meet me tonight at 7:30 in the parking lot of Christ the King Lutheran Church on Huguenot Road. I said, fine, where is that? He repeated it. I said, one more time. He repeated it again. I said, John, let me get a pencil and a piece of paper, write this down. And so I did. I wrote it down. Which will give you a picture of how befuddled I had become in my alcoholism. I could crawl to that church on my hands and knees and not tear the knees out. I lived 7 blocks from that church. Don't have to cross any major streets to get there. But I'd probably been by it 3,000 or 4,000 times. But I didn't know where it was that morning. So here we go. Raining like heck. It was a real frog-strangling rain. We're sitting in his car smoking cigarettes, and this guy who has missed it altogether is telling me things about him that I would never share with another human being about me. I am odd. I knew a lot about sports. I knew why you're losing your hair. That's not natural for you. You're an alcoholic. You know what happens in your case? It's like grilled cream. A little dab will do it. A whole tube. Boom! Got to have it, and your hair falls out. We do things in extremes. I was a good newspaper man. I could take a few salient facts from you, and I could compose a readable and very truthful story about whatever you were telling me. But if you had asked me to write anything about me, I couldn't have given you more than maybe 50 words of biography because I had no idea. None. It depended on what the weather was like. It depended on how business was going. It depended on how my wife was treating me. It depended on the way you looked at me. That's how life was going. And so I'm just spellbound by what this guy has just shared with me. And he said, come on, now we're going to a meeting. I didn't know what I was getting into, folks. You may have sensed already that I didn't have much use for societies and organizations and clubs that I've been thrown out of every one of them, Boy Scouts, Sea Scouts, you name it. even one Catholic club. And I called the priest on his cell phone in front of 50 people one time. He didn't appreciate it. And I didn't know what I was getting into, but I appreciated what I did not see on the way into that room. You didn't ask me who I was. You didn't ask me what I did for a living. You didn't ask me whether or not I played golf, what kind of a car I drove, how much money I made a year, whether I had ever slept with my sister. You didn't ask me anything. You didn't need to know my name. You knew what I was. If there had been an open candle in that room, folks, nobody would have survived the blast if I got near there and breathed on it. I mean, I was just oozing. And he gave me the best news I ever got in my entire life. I mean, I thought I was crazy. So many do, I hear in the rooms. But I thought if I shared what was going on in my brain with anybody, I would get snapped into a complimentary room with the rubber Ramada. That's hard to say when your lips are dry. The rubber Ramada down in Petersburg or Eastern State or Western State or wherever they could find a room for me. Because it wasn't pretty. I seriously thought about calling Paranoids Anonymous one time, but I knew damn well they wouldn't tell me where the meetings were, you know. And you said, if you keep coming back, Joe, we can teach you how to live with what you have. Wow. Nobody was inviting me back. I had been the life of the party in my neighborhood. You know, there was no email at that particular time when I was hot-shotting on the road. So, you know, the salesman came in with all the jokes from a week's work. He got invited to every party there was. In fact, I inaugurated a few parties that weren't on the schedule, and one of them, the last Christmas party I ever went to, wasn't on anybody's schedule either. One of my best drinking buddies lived a block away. I staggered on down there about 11 o'clock Christmas Eve, and I pounded on his door. I said, I'm here for the party, John. He said, we're not having a party. I said, yes, you are, you know. And they're trying to wrap gifts. And I woke up about 3 o'clock that morning on their couch, and there was a note pinned to my sweater. It said, Dear Santa, if Joe is here when you come, please take him with you when you leave, okay? So I was socially unacceptable in my own neighborhood with my own friends and my own drinking buddies now. And you guys are saying, come on back. We'll help you. I said, oh, I think I'm going to give this one a shot, and I did. And I was skeptical of Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here. I come from Massachusetts. There's a lot of corruption up there. I'd seen an awful lot of it when I was a reporter. I had been in the state house down there when I was doing some freelance political stuff. I had seen what was going on, guys buying and selling their mother-in-laws over on the state's phone time, you know, for a sidewalk contract. I'd seen it all. So I wasn't really a trusting person. And then I took a look at you guys and said, you know, you got 2 million members. It was about a million then. And all this money and, you know, so on and so forth, and there's got to be a scam or a power structure here that, you know, really hurting this thing along. And so I looked askance at what you were doing, and someday I would catch you. You know, I had done a lot of investigative reporting, and so every time I saw a rock that looked, you know, an AA rock that looked like it might have something under it, I tipped it over. And I was disappointed I wasn't finding anything. I have a good sponsor. He passed away. He'll be dead a year in September. And, of course, he went from Alzheimer's and a couple of other things. And as soon as he didn't remember who I was, I got another one immediately. But this guy was exactly who I needed. Item one, I didn't want a darn sponsor. I was 50 years old. What did I want a sponsor for? I didn't need that kind of special friend. I hope you don't think I'm, you know, being personal about this, but I followed him around. He was also in the clothing industry. We had a lot in common. Plus the fact that he was at the first meeting I went to, and I liked what he seemed to be getting out of life. So after about 3 or 4 months, I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, Larry, will you be my sponsor? He said, it's too late. I already am, you know. But he was exactly who I needed. He didn't push. He didn't shove. He didn't tell me how to leave my life. He showed me how he led his. He didn't say, get in the car. He said, I need some help. Would you come with me? You know? And he got me introduced to and involved in service. Before I knew it, I had keys to two churches. I was setting up 2 meetings a week. Now, I told you I was dead broke, right? And everybody was on my tail. There were no alarm systems on the churches back then. There was mutual trust and respect in the community. But there's a lot of valuable stuff in those places. And I'm thinking to myself, I could probably get a small business going here in the liturgical aftermarket, you know, solve some of my financial problems. But then I said, no, but I would disappoint the people who were giving me the trust. And so my trust in Alcoholics Anonymous began to build, and I began to get involved in service. My sponsor appointed me a group service representative for a group that he had just started. I said, what do I do? He said, nothing. Until I tell you. Okay. Eventually he said to me one day, come to this meeting at this office on Tuesday night. So I went over there. And he was the DCM. I didn't know. District committee member. And so he kept on nudging me along. It gave me a chance to stop turning over the rocks. I was still, in the back of my mind, on the search for the power structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys elected me to be your state chairman. And as such, I was allowed to go down to a regional forum down in Hollywood. I always wanted to go to Hollywood, Florida, for a weekend, at which would be the many members of the General Service Board, our trustees, delegates from all over the Southeast and other parts of the country were going to be there. And it was at this meeting that I knew that somebody would wrap a fatherly arm around my shoulder and say something like, Joe, we've been watching you. And we think we can trust you with some additional information now. And we'd like you to meet us in the smoke-filled back room after the next session. You know, we're going to sort of fill you in where you can get your big books wholesale, you know, your belt buckle, you know, cheap and the whole deal. And that didn't happen. But I did. While I was there, that weekend, discover the power center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to wait for a cab to take me down to the Miami airport, and I was standing on this beach behind this hotel. I don't even know what body of water I was looking out at. I must have been levitating or close to it, because here came the kid from Muscle City with the 10 pins. He walked right up to me, and he said, pardon me, sir, are you Dr. Timothy Leary? And I said, not this trip. I was higher than a kite, though, because I had found that weekend the power center of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's its love and concern for the still suffering drunk. That's it, period, amen. Now I could give myself permission to fall in love with the fellowship. It's been good to me in many respects. I told you I had, you know, become a social outcast. I was, fast slipping out of my industry. Had about 2 strikes on me there. But I had that also, that the alcoholic's seventh sense keeps you one step ahead of the sheriff most of the time. Yeah. Speaking of that, by the way, when I told my sponsor one day that I was going to file for bankruptcy because I was certainly bankrupt, he said, no, you're not. He said, you've got financial amends to make to those people. It took me 5 years, and it wasn't easy. And there were days I didn't think, money fell out of the sky, from mysterious places. And I was able to survive those 5 years with the help of a good member of this fellowship who also happened to be an accountant and clean it all up. And I'm so glad he held my nose to the grindstone on that one. Yeah, I remember calling him up one day. This is early on. I said, Larry, I'm sitting here. You know what a neurotic is? A neurotic is somebody who's going in 3 directions at one time with his foot nailed to the floor. I'm at my desk. And I'm into one of these, big neurotic spells. I call him up. I say, I got a stack of unfinished work over here, a stack of unpaid bills over here. I'm afraid to, let the blinds up, you know, I don't want to go to the mailbox, and, you know, all of that. And he said, do something good with your body. I said, ooh, I'm going to like this program. He said, no, stupid, take a walk. And I did. Well, it worked. So anyway, I learned to trust the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the process that we live our lives by. I have good relationships in all facets of my life today. And that's through the steps. What do we get? 4 and 5, I establish my relationships with myself. 6 and 7 with my higher power. And 8 and 9 with the society I lived in. You know, he gave me that opportunity. And today, I have 3 families today. I mean, it's wonderful. I have the family I was born into, what's left of us. I have the family I sired. And I have the family of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all over the world. In like 175 countries, with over 2 million members. And in all of my travels, I've never walked into an AA meeting and been anything but welcome. I knew I was home, no matter where I was, what was going on. Port in the storm, believe me. There was a girl, young college gal with a clipboard one day, came to one of our meetings, and she said, I would like half a dozen of you, if you have time after the meeting, to answer some questions for me so I can complete my term paper. I said, well, I better get in that line. You know, I wanted to hear it right. I'm an expert. And the first question was, what is it that you like most about Alcoholics Anonymous? And, you know, I was stuck for an answer. I'd never defined it. But you guys always told me to look deep down inside because that's where the truth really was. And I did. And I said, the fellowship. So even though my relationships, you know, they're good across the board today, and I hope I never have to make a choice between them. I'm happy with them the way they are, but I want you to know I love this fellowship, and I love it deeply. It gives me the opportunity to fill that void, as I mentioned. Now, not only do I get a chance to experience the miracle of my own sobriety, but I also get the chance to contribute from time to time to the miracle of somebody else's sobriety. And I don't know what more I can ask for in life. How much more impact I can have on somebody, you know, with what I've got to work with. It's been such a wonderful journey. If you're new, or nearly new, or not around long enough, I want to warn you. There's an old lady. I couldn't call her an old lady. I was in love with her. She died when she was about 90. She used to lie about her age. Ruth Dickens from down in Lynchburg. If you ever met Ruth, you'd have to love her. I told Ruth one day, if you were 20 minutes younger and I were 20 minutes older, I'd chase you. I loved her because she did not wear the mantle of sobriety too tightly. And some of what she told me reminds me of a story that I heard about Puritans. And I know there are some in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to those meetings. A Puritan who goes around brooding all day over the fact that somebody, somewhere, is having a good time or enjoying themselves, you know? Now, I'll illustrate that to you by story. Here comes a stud muffin. He's got his court papers in his pocket, and just by chance he walks into a meeting. It's a small town, there aren't many meetings. He walks into this meeting and there's 7 guys sitting there who have been sitting there for the last 22 years, you know. And they just sort of rub their hands and say, oh, fresh meat, you know. I mean, they had heard their stories ad infinitum. And they said, son, why don't you tell us about your last drunk? He said, well, he said, I was in this hot tub with 3 naked women. And one of the old guys leaned back and said, son, you keep on coming back here, you'll never have to live like that again. If you walk into one of those meetings, exit immediately, right, left, through the window, out the door, it doesn't make any difference, because the recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is in the laughter and not in the tears. And go for it, write it for all it's worth, and I thank you.